365 days a year.
Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of Money Talk. I'm Neil Kreisel and Diane Duva and I, your hosts, every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 11, and on Saturdays at 6. We're brought to you by Broadview Mortgage, whose highly trained and experienced team takes great pride in helping people with home financing, offering competitive rates, and a wide array of loan programs. And Arnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1937, located on the corner of Olive and Cota Street in downtown Santa Barbara. And Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm in Santa Barbara, providing its clients with the personal care and attention of a small independent firm coupled with the vast resources of a major financial institution.
Hi, Neil. How are you doing today?
I am older.
You did. You celebrated a birthday. Happy birthday to you.
Thank you. It is.
Do you feel older is the question?
I do, but I felt older 2 days before that and 3 days before that, and it's one of those things that keeps happening.
Hey, it's better than the alternative, right?
It is definitely better than the alternatives. But I have to deal with that again, hopefully, in another 365 days.
Four.
Isn't it leap year coming up?
No.
I can be younger. So, one of the interesting things about the current investment environment is that there has been, over the last few years, an attempt by some investors to not only time the market, which is, again, maybe a very difficult task, but also to diversify and make explicit judgments about which economy is going to do better. So there was a period of time a few years ago where certain countries were preferred over America, Latin American countries, and versus
I think what's important here is to talk about just global diversity. So at Arlington, what we do is we allocate assets to not only just U.S. investments, but also international investments, whether it be Europe or Asia. And so the point, I think, of your article is that people try to do that and then go ahead and then they...
Are you reading over
I'm
my
reading
shoulder?
I'm reading over your shoulder across the room, Neil.
Okay. So the theme of this article is that you have to be careful because so many, if not the vast majority of international companies may not be a play on the country you think. So, for example, Infosys, which is a large Indian company, which
Infosys.
We
give them some latitude.
Infosys.
In this room.
I hired them in actually in one of the bank roles that I did.
Okay, this is our guest Christine Garvey, who is a linguist, and I've asked her to be here today because, as a New Yorker, I have some struggle pronouncing things. So this company, which will go nameless, which is
why don't we just talk about it in terms of Coca-Cola is a great one.
Well, but this one I have statistics on. This company has only 3%. It's an Indian company, but only 3% of its sales come from India, whereas 60% of its sales come from North America. So when someone invests in that company in order to have an exposure outside of America, they're not getting what they think they're getting. And the article goes on to say that it's true in general. So, for example, during the Brexit disaster a year ago, many people thought that the London stock market would decline. Instead, it went up. And why? This article talks about the possibility that of the top 100 British companies, roughly 72% of their revenue comes from outside of Britain. And so when the stock market went down because people were afraid of the economy in England, the reality was that most of the companies that were going down, exposure was to other than English businesses. And the flip side of this, which is interesting, is that for those investors that want to invest in America because they believe America is the place to go, of the S&P 500, 450 companies have more than 15% of their revenue from outside the U.S. And in fact, even Amazon and Apple and Costco and Home Depot have a significant part of their revenue outside of America. So if you want a pure American play, you're not going to get it with the S&P 500.
Right. And I think that also helps our companies when we're having U.S. domestic issues. It's best that you have a diversified consumer purchasing power, not just coming from the U.S., but also coming from Europe.
Right. So the next article that I think is interesting is that for the first quarter of this year, nearly half of people who refinance their homes chose the cash out option. That is, they weren't simply redoing a refinancing to get lower interest rates. They were doing it to take cash or cash for their equity. And the implications of that, as the article goes on to say, has several directions. One is that it may have been one of the reasons why our consumer spending, which is 70% of the economy, has done so well, because people are taking money out of their house and spending it. And the other aspect is that there are consumers and or homeowners that really have been saddled with payments for school loans and other things that they need to be able to pay for that isn't supported by their incomes. And so the article says it's too early to be worried about over-leverage because people are less leveraged than they were before, but it is something to consider.
Well, you know, what's interesting about that is what I've seen in my client base is those people that did a home refinance and cashed money out, most of them earmarked those funds for home improvements, which before 2008, really that wasn't the case. They were taking money out to pay off loans, to pay off debts, consumer debt, to go on vacations. It was a much different, a lot easier time with free money than it was now, than what I'm seeing now. What I'm seeing now is really home improvements, which is what you should be taking money out of real estate and doing with it.
As opposed to leaving it to your children.
Yes, or yes. Buying your children things.
Or
yes.
Buying your children things. Well, you could buy your children things with the cash that you take out. So the next article I brought in is about how quantitative investing, which is something that if you pick up the newspaper today and look at the financial section, you're going to be hearing about, because so many professional investors are literally firing their analysts and hiring computers.
And this goes back near and dear to your heart in history, because you were a analyst.
I was an analyst, and I replaced myself. I did not wait for the computer to replace me. Now, that was early. I did that for...
Or upper management.
Well, I did that for 30 years ago. I anticipated that, but I was early.
Perhaps a little too early.
Yeah, right? And the thing about being prescient was that they didn't have computers in those days.
You were really a couple steps ahead.
I was a couple steps ahead. Actually, they did have computers. But here's the interesting thing. This article, which is in the Wall Street Journal, talks about how analyst took every rule of thumb that really good analysts were using to pick stocks and did a comprehensive list, and then took it to a computer expert and had them put it into an algorithm. So you had a computer algorithm essentially doing exactly the same thing as analysts were doing. And then what he did is he compared over several years the performance of the computer to the analyst that gave the advice about how they invest. And what do you think happened?
The computer won.
The computer won. And so you would say, how could that be? And the reason is, one of the good things about computers, if there are good things about computers, is that if the rules are right, and that's a big debate, they won't let emotion get in the way. Whereas investors tend to be subject to tripping over their own prejudices and behavioral mistakes. And so if you think you know what to do, there are things you're going to do that, because you're not disciplined enough, you just won't do. For example, investors tend not to want to realize their losses, even if the computer says, well, I don't want to take that loss, as if it makes a difference whether you take the loss or you have the loss.
What I see is people are, on the loss front, it's harder to get people to deploy cash when the market's down. So a great example is in 2009, beginning of March, when it was the lowest point, everybody thought the world was going to end. No one said, oh, I have all this excess cash, let's put it to work in the market. Now, had you had done that, you'd be sitting quite nicely up at this point. But those are the type of emotions that people have a hard time overcoming.
You're absolutely right. And the one person that did that and was criticized for being an old man and really not with it was Warren Buffett. And what Warren Buffett did is he invested...
If that's someone not with it, I'd love to be that.
Well, but people criticized him because his performance was bad and he kept buying. And people said, boy, he just doesn't understand what's happening, that the world is coming to an end. And so far, although listening to the news the last 2 days, it may be coming to an end. I just got a tweet today, which I'm not going to get into.
That's the emotion side.
That's the emotional side. You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
For prospective homebuyers, one of the most important steps of the loan process is getting clear and honest information from someone who will speak plainly and truthfully about loan programs and options.
Hello, I'm Kelly Marsh, the branch manager of Broadview Mortgage in Santa Barbara, where our highly skilled and experienced team takes great pride in helping clients obtain home financing with honest, knowledgeable, fast, friendly, and efficient service. As a Santa Barbara area native who has spent the past 19 years in the mortgage industry and has closed over 4,000 loans, I'd appreciate the opportunity to earn your business and invite you to visit BroadviewSB.com or call my office at 805-563-1100 to learn more about how Broadview Mortgage can help you determine the best way to manage mortgage debt to achieve a more stable financial future.
Licensed by the Department of Business Oversight under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act, license number 813G136, NMLS number 170528, an equal housing lender.
The Foundation for Santa Barbara City College is a nonprofit organization which supports our own Santa Barbara City College. The Foundation for Santa Barbara City College, or SBCC, funds scholarships, childcare, book grants, and other programs. Without these, many students simply would not be able to attend college. There is an amazing range of academic and vocational studies offered at City College, which encourage students to find their passion and their talents. As a donor to the foundation, you have the power to change lives. Please help our community college by donating to the Foundation for SBCC. Call 730-4401 or visit us at sbccfoundation.org to find out how you can help. That's 730-4401 or sbccfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Broadview Mortgage since 1988, a mortgage banker and direct lender that believes in providing in-depth loan consulting to its customers in a personalized and honest manner. And we can be reached at 564-1290.
Or you could also email us at moneytalk1290@gmail.com. Mm. And we have in studio today Christine Garvey, and she is a board member to publicly traded companies, which, in case you don't know, is a real accomplishment given the makeup of women to men on publicly traded company boards. And she's also a former global head of corporate real estate at Deutsche Bank, as well as also formerly at Cisco. So welcome, Christine. Thank you for being here with us today.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about how you got to where you are now. What's your history?
Well, you know, as you mentioned, I went to law school. But you mean earlier on than that, I grew up in Los Angeles. And after I graduated from college, I wanted to go back east. And decided, and I was going to be a lawyer. My dad, my grandfather, my uncle were all lawyers. And so I was going to go to law school. And the law school in San Francisco I was going to go to, where my dad went, I applied too late. So I applied to every law school in Boston, and Suffolk accepted me. And I went across country and went to law school. And then decided to stay in Boston and ended up actually spending the next 15 years in upper New England.
So now, did you want to be an attorney from the time you were little, or?
Pretty much so. And I was actually going to practice with my dad. There was a law firm that my dad, my uncle, my grandfather founded called Newman, Newman & Newman, my maiden name. And so I was going to jump into that. But 3 months before I graduated, my dad died. And my uncle had gone on to the Superior Court bench, and my grandfather had died. So I ended up staying back east, and I was one of the first 100 women practicing law in the state of Vermont.
Wow. Well, thank you. A crack in the ceiling, we'll call that.
There were 4 women in a class of 300 when I went to law school.
Wow. But,
and now in the same law school at Suffolk University in Boston, probably greater than 50% are women.
So it's definitely more equalized.
Big out. Difference, yeah.
Now, after law school, so you practiced law for 4 or 5 years, is that what you said?
For a number of years in Vermont, and my ex-husband and I owned ski hotels, and we restored historic properties.
Oh.
So we did that, and then probably it was 1984, I came back to California. The marriage had ended. And had lunch with one of my high school girlfriends. I went to a Catholic girls' school in Los Angeles, and she was working for First Interstate Bank at that time, and which is no more. Wells Fargo bought them. And I told her I needed a job, and she said, well, there's this dead-end job in corporate real estate at First Interstate.
Wow, she really sold it to you.
Yeah.
Huh?
And I said, well, sounds fine. And so I started, and then 3 months after I started, the head of the department was escorted out of the bank for self-dealing. And so I became head of the department. So it was actually a great opening. And I suggest this sometimes, too, when I speak to women's groups. It's a good path of success to succeed somebody who is a crook. You look pretty good.
Yeah, the bar's a little lower,
yes.
Right? So now the restoring of the ski hotels, is that really where you found the passion in real estate?
Yes, I think so. And I love New England, beautiful houses. And we ran the ski hotel, which is when only 2 people run the whole thing. You're working 24 hours a day. And we put in an adult tennis camp. And it was a lot of fun. It was successful. However, we ended up selling it to a Brit who wanted to retire and run a ski hotel. But it was a big operation. And he underestimated how much you need really local people to sustain it in the off season. And he was not particularly jovial nor welcoming to the locals. So he had a hard time of it. But we were out of it by that point.
And so when you went into banking, did you have a banking background? Were you interested? No.
No, I had no background in banking at all, but I had in real estate, and I was a lawyer. So that was helpful, though I never practiced law in California. And so at that time, I think, if I remember correctly, it was so long ago, First Interstate had about 7 million square feet. So this was all the buildings, all the property that the bank occupied, and it would include data centers, branches, office buildings. And then when I was recruited 2 years later to go to Wells Fargo, and I was at Wells for 5 years and had a bigger portfolio. It was probably about 15 million square feet at that time. It was before the merger with Norwest. And spent a lot of time, you know, working with developers, with brokers. And it was a lot of fun.
So in that role, were you in what portions of the real estate did you spend most of your time? I'd imagine most of the procurement was done. But were you renovating it? Were you expanding?
Well, you have property managers. So most of it, as it became more professionalized, you know, it was not highly thought of in a bank at that particular time. You were managing, if you were a real estate developer, you were managing a lot of real estate if you had 13 million or 15 million square feet. But at that time, it was probably the second highest cost to the bank behind HR. And so you were looking, I had about 200 people who worked for me. So you were looking for new branch sites. You had third-party managers for the real estate, whether it was CBRE or Jones Lang LaSalle. And then you had to have specialists to develop trading floors, put those together for the bank. And when I went to B of A, we had 60 million square feet in 50 countries. So still with 100, reduced it to about 150 people who managed.